Okay. So first of all, I'd like to apologize that I will speak to you in English. We will continue now the theme of vision. And the theme I will talk about will be quite similar to José, but I'd like to give you two new insights. One is an insight from an experimentalist. So I would like to show you experiments that you can get convinced yourself that these themes that José introduced are really ongoing in your brain and in the retina. In the first part, I will just show you experiments, some of them real time, some of them I just explain. And the second part, I will let you be part of the experiments. And the second theme that I like to introduce you, that much of what your vision is designed for is look at motion. And this will be a theme throughout the lecture, that how our initial eye brain system deals with motion, and then later on how your percept have your internal capabilities to deal with vision. So if you look at this picture, there is a pattern of photons that arrives to your eye, and your eye converts it to a neuronal activity, then that sort of marches to your brain and leads to a percept. So within an eye, as you heard, there are two kinds of structures. There are structures that remind us to an optical laboratory, that there is a lens, there is an aperture. So this is the physics that your eye made to project precisely the image at the back, at the screen, which is called the retina. And as you heard from José, that the retina is not a normal screen. It does have some properties of a screen. For example, here it has a layer that captures the photon. But then during this, you see these other layers in the retina and a lot of processing elements that is completely different from just an image capture device. And what your retina is indeed doing, this is looking at a video, this is shown here, in real time producing 20 neuronal representations that feeds your brain, and in real time, your brain is looking only at these neuronal representations that leaves the eye and guessing what is out there. So there are 20 such representations, and somehow your brain is putting together what is out here. So very briefly, I like to summarize how we think about these representations. Some of this was already introduced by José, but I like to give an account from the view of a computer. So I'd like to tell you that what you have in your eye is a computer that can perform very precise calculations. I will show you some of these calculations and how. So everything starts with a photoreceptor, which is during daylight, this is called cone photoreceptors, which are looking at a pixel and capturing photons. And from here, information flows to what we call a bipolar cell. And the bipolar cell itself a computer. It's a computer because it has a receiver, this dendrite, and a transmitter, its axon terminal. But the information that comes in the receiver is very different than comes out in the transmitter. So if you look at this old phone, many of you probably experienced that you hear comes something completely different than the person is telling you, because there is some processor in the old time that was just distorted. Today, it's just better, but there's a processor inside, so something different comes in and different comes out. So this is a computation at the nerve cell level. Now, there's not only one bipolar cell, but as José told you, there are many types of bipolar cells. So what the photoreceptor is telling the brain is now listened by at least 12 or 10 types of bipolar cells. So you have receivers to listen to these photoreceptor message, but they have different internal computers. So what comes out of them is completely different. So you already have 10 different understanding of the cone message. And these are so-called excitatory neurons, that they are excitatory because if you talk to another neuron, then another neuron also gets excited. So this is like a chain that I tell you something, you get excited. You tell your friend, you get excited. This is what we have in the retina, so-called excitatory neuronal chains. But we also have inhibitory neurons, such as this guy here. They are called amacrine cells. And what they do is that when they get excited, they shut down the other person. So somebody's telling me not to talk, This is an inhibitory neuron. And the key point is about computation is that in your brain and in the retina, these inhibitory and excitatory cells constantly talk. And the output neuron of the retina, the ganglion cell you heard about, is constantly listening to a bunch of bipolar cells and a bunch of inhibitory cells, what they are selling. And whenever there are more excitation inhibition, the ganglion cells send a unit information to the brain. This we call a spike. Okay? If there are more inhibition, the ganglion cell is just simply silent. So the ganglion cell can be silent or send a unit information to the brain. So this is what I call a conference call, because the ganglion cell is on a conference call all the time. It has to decide what to do or do nothing. Okay, so this is how we think about this little circuitry in the retina. We have, if this little circuit is looking at a point in Roger Federer space, this one, a photoreceptor, and the output is a ganglion cell, and there's a changing intensity at this point, and the ganglion cell sometimes decides to send a spike, but most of the time it is silent. So there's a little calculation by this circuitry, and let's just now make things a bit simpler as we go ahead. So here is a circuitry, but indeed we don't need these sophisticated drawings. We can represent these neuronal elements, these little machines with numbers and circles and connectivities. And we can even further simplify just these numbers representing the neuronal element in this tiny computer. So as I told you that this little circuitry is watching one pixel in Federer space, or in your case, there's a little circuit in your eye that, let's say, watching one point on my face currently. But obviously, you see my entire face or entire Federer face. So this circuitry is repeated in your retina. There's a mosaic of such little computational elements. And this is like the elementary processing unit of your eye, this circuit mosaic. And what this circuit mosaic is doing, this is watching the entire scene. It has these processors at every pixel, and then compute something here. Basically, each ganglion cell is sending spikes to the brain, and what I show here is the average firing frequency of a ganglion cell type. The key point here that you have three kinds of calculations that your retina is doing here. One kind of calculation within a nerve cell. I told you that the input and an output is different within a nerve cell. Within the circuitry, I showed you that these few cells, the photoreceptor to ganglion cell, is doing a calculation and sending some spikes when it decides to, based on some features. And the third one, that these circuits on your retina are not independent. There are connections among them. So there is also computation across circuitry. But the key point is that such a circuitry is nothing else than a nonlinear image processing device that can pull out some features from the incoming video to your eye and sends that to the brain. Now, why the retina is such an interesting piece to study? Because we don't have only one such a mosaic calculating some feature, but we have 20 mosaics. These are stacked, organized in your retina. And as a result, they compute 20 representations for the brain to listen to and to conclude what is out there. Many of these representations, indeed, have to do with motion. So what I'd like to do now is that after this introduction, I show you some real features that a real retina calculates. So just one summary point, that the retina is a standalone, sophisticated image processing device. It's very important it's standalone, but it means that the brain has no feedback connections to the retina back. That means it has several consequences. One is that if anything goes wrong in your retina, the brain is very hard to correct. It's very hard to correct. You just have to listen to what the retina is saying. The second point is an evolutionary point, is that the retina evolves, and the brain is a slave of the retina. It can do nothing, but if you have a new setup, a new circuitry, the brain is plastic, you have to figure out what to do with it. The only way the brain can influence your vision is through eye motion, so you can change your eye motion, but not the computation that is ongoing in your retina. The second point is that this device creates 20 movies about the visual world around us, And these movies are sort of letters for the visual language. So one way you can think about the visual system, that the retina creates the ABC, and the higher center will create the words, and that even higher center create the sentences, and somewhere the percept is formed. Okay, so this was an abstract introduction. You either believe me or not. What I like to do now is actually show you that some of what I told you is actually true. So we will now go experimental mode, and we ask ourselves, how can we actually measure visual features? And something remarkable about the retina, that because it does not get input from the brain, we can peel it off, put in a device, and record from it, and show visual stimuli. So in real time, we can watch a biological computer. And this is what I will show you. And the first key point I like to make here is that, of course, if there are hundreds of neuronal elements in the retina, and we can record from it, there's a dilemma, is that how can we record from a specific element? If I'm blind who I'm record to, it could take hundreds of years until I understand the retina. And the key point is that allows us now to really record in an intelligent way from the retina, is that these circuit elements I told you, the retina circuit elements, each has a unique genetic identity. And because of this genetic unique identity, people figured out all sorts of clever ways to light up, to label individual elements. So each out of the 100 elements can be individually labeled, and we can create, for example, transgenic mice, where a single type, one out of 100, is just labeled. Now, if you look at such a mouse, for example, here is the retina of a mouse, which is peeled off, and every little dot here is one and only one type of cell among the 100 within the retina. And the beauty of that you can take this mouse, you can give it to your colleagues, and all of you can study the same type of retinal ganglion cell. You don't have to explain that you know the one that will do this and that, that will be too complex. Here, and that was a huge revolution in brain science, that now we can label cell types, and now we can record, we can take an electrode and record from them. So the first question, what is computed? So I will look at now this mouse line, which I just showed you, and take an electrode and record from a cell and show you what this cell does. And of course, it was not me who did the experiment, but a graduate student in my lab, Antonio Drinenberg, who also made this movie, which I'll just show you. And so this is how we record, that we take an apparatus here, she opens the door, and there is some complex microscope here. And as I told you, we can peel off the retina and put on a filter paper shown here. And make on the filter paper, we make a hole and put the retina on the top. You don't see anything because the retina is transparent. That's important. That's why you see. Okay, and then we can show a movie on the retina. The movie is coming from below. It's a very simple movie. This is just a moving dot. You know, the simpler the movie, the easier to understand. Then she takes a little pipette shown here, fills up with some saline, and then puts an objective and maneuvers these electrodes under the microscope. And then look at the retina. You see a second. Here is the retina. The cells are unlabeled, so each of these little dots is a ganglion cell. And now she turns on the two-photon microscope and sees the genetically labeled one. So now we know this is a single type. And then she starts to do some manipulations. First, it's very hard to record these are individual cells. So she does some cleaning steps. So she messes around with an electrode. And now, again, now he puts on a cell and now confirms that, yes, this is the one out of the 100 type. This is the one that we want to record. And now she starts to record. And now we hope that the movie works. And she puts a stimulus and the ganglion cells start to spike. So this is what it sends normally to the brain. The brain is not there in this case. And these are the spikes, the yeses that the cell produces when there is something interesting. So what I will tell you, what is interesting for this particular type of ganglion cell. Okay. What's amazing is the following. that this ganglion cell produces a lot of spikes when it, and no spike when it comes back. It's truly amazing. Check in. A lot of spike. No spike. Okay, this was discovered 50 years ago, and this was a complete miracle at the time, because you know, in the retina is not as big as your brain. It's a little sheet. It's three or four synapses away from the photoreceptors. And I have a ganglion cell, and I have now this device going this way, and the ganglion cell sees it, it responds to it, and I go backwards, it's complete silence. There's nothing. The ganglion cell, as if there would be absolutely nothing out there. So what do we know about these cells? These cells detect motion direction. They are very clever because, for example, you see that they almost produce zero spike if the motion is this way, and they produce a lot of spikes when the motion is that way. And they produce sort of a little bit less spike if motion is that way, and you see this gradient from zero to what we call the preferred motion. Okay, so what I just showed you, that in the eye, there's a mosaic of cells, at least one mosaic, that prefers a single direction of motion. So the obvious question you ask yourself is that, oh, maybe I have such a mosaic for every direction. You can refute this hypothesis because then you would have an infinite number of ganglion cells, but much more likely that we have a source of a coordinate. If you would have only one, that would be not so useful. The likely thing is that we have some, a finite number, but which direction do we label? And to answer this question, we have to use a different technology, which Jose introduced you. These are multi-electrodes. What we want to do now, statistically, we want to read out from all the ganglion cells, what kind of motion direction do they represent? What kind of mosaics they have? And of course, you can build 100 different transgenic mouse, go by one, but again, that would take you 100 years. So now it's better to use a technology that can give you a statistical view of the retina. And what we use here is multi-electrode arrays. So multi-electrode technology started with few, 64 electrodes. But recently, Andreas Hirlemann in ETH has built some arrays which has 30,000 electrodes. The new one has 80,000 electrodes. And so you can put a retina on this little chip and essentially can read out all ganglion cells simultaneously in a small patch of the retina, maybe a millimeter by millimeter. And when you do that, we can, within one day, we just put the retina, we get a lot of, we can, 30,000 cells you can collect, and then you can compute a lot on them, and then you can just look at it, and you see that we have, in the mouse retina, for example, in the rabbit retina, we have four directions represented. Indeed, we know from many other studies that there are eight retinal mosaics that are involved in the creation of these four different image motion representations. Okay, so our conclusion that there is a nice coordinate system in the retina, and this coordinate system can tell you what is left, right, up, and down. But all what I told you is still a phenomenology. I told you that, look, here is a retina. I record for something, and something miraculous happens, and a little bit I can understand about it. But this is not real science. This is just descriptive science. What we really want to get at is what is in this black box. What is happening between the photoreceptors? We would like to understand every step, how we come up with a directional selectivity. Then you have a dilemma, which I will try to resolve later. The dilemma is that how much we really want to understand biology. Isn't it just enough to describe it? And I like to tell you that this dilemma is always about something that the resolution of things system we would like to study, how much resolution we study, well, depending on the personal interest. But it also depends whether it is important what you find in the black box. And this I'd like to get to that is deeply important for medicine to figure out this black box. So first I will show you what is in the black box, and I show you a disease that depends on what we found in the black box. So how is computed? That's the question. And for this, there are many ways you can determine that, and then the people use all sorts of methodologies, but I just show you one that we like very much, because this is a nature-made machine. So we'd like to figure out a machine that nature makes, a clever machine. Nature usually makes clever machines. that is somehow help us to discover what are the circuit elements of that ganglion cell. And what we use is a very clever virus and clever people who engineered them to be extremely useful. It was Ed Calavay, Klaus Konzelmann, and Ian Wickersham, who also used this rabies virus. A rabies virus has this amazing property that if you put them into somehow into a nerve cell, they have the ability to travel across connected cells, but only in one way, against the information flow. So this is something that if I talk to you all the time, but you never talk to me, so I only then I put the virus to you, it comes back to me. If you put the virus to me, it doesn't go to you. So this is great. And the second great thing, because if you would just initiate them, they would go all over, right? So everything would be labeled. That it was engineered such a way by these people that it can go only one step. So even you are connected to, or I'm connected to a lot of other people, it doesn't matter. It only shows you who is talking to me. And this is exactly what we need here, because we know there are two synapses, and we from other studies know that the computation lies somewhere here between these inhibitory excitatory cells telling fire or not fire. Okay, so Keisuke Yonehara in my lab decided to just simply use this virus and initiate from a single cell, and then label the ones that talk into it and figure out who they are and what they do. So this is a way, this is this little virus that now labeling a few ganglion cells in the retina. This is this mosaic I showed you, and each of these is a little circuitry of a single ganglion cell. So you can zoom into one of these. In the middle, you see this direction selective ganglion cell I showed you. And these are the computational elements where the secret lies. And if you look at more closely, this is what you see, that these cells have a completely unique property, the inhibitory cells. The excitatory cells are rather boring. They just provide excitation. So they, whenever there is a stimulus coming, they tell me to fire if I'm the directional selective cell. But these inhibitory neurons are remarkable. And that is that they somehow figure out what is left and right, and they connect to the ganglion cell very strongly from one direction and very weakly from another direction. So if I am, for example, an upward motion or an leftward motion direction ganglion cell, so this one, I have very little connectivity. Sorry, this case, this ganglion cell would fire a lot if the stimulus would come from this way, and very little if the stimulus comes this way. Why? Because the connectivity strength from this side is very weak and from the other one is very strong, such that I'm coming here, this inhibitory cell very weakly connected, and when I arrive, the ganglion cell will start to fire. When I come from the other side, however, see that this inhibitor is very strongly connected, and before I arrive to the ganglion cell with my stimulus, this cell will tell the ganglion cell not to fire. This is an inhibitory cell. Okay, so there they vote not to fire, and the ganglion cell will not fire. So at the essence of the computation is an asymmetric connectivity between inhibitory neuron and the ganglion cell. So this is the circuit logic of motion detection in the retina. So before we go to who cares, I just like to summarize that we have seen a neuronal computation. The unique genetic identity of circuit elements together with viral imaging and electronic technologies allows us to study neuronal computation at the level of circuit components, connectivity, and dynamics. And as a result, in the retina, we can assign specific roles to cell types and circuits. So now we start our journey of explaining you why we should care about this detail, why anybody would care. So the first thing we ask, that what retinal directional therapy is good for in you or in a mouse or in the rabbit. And the key point is that these directional selective ganglion cells have two radiations, two different radiations in the brain. Some of them are conserved across all the species we know, mammalian species, this green part, which I will talk about. And some of them are not conserved, likely, or we're not fully sure, likely that this non-conserved part towards the visual cortex is mostly present in mice and rodents and rabbits, but not in monkeys and humans. However, this part is conserved. Okay, and this is what the directional selective is good for. So this is an eye, and this is what happens when you look out in the train. So you look out at the train, many of you notice that your eyes following the trees, and then they jump back, and they follow and jump back. And this reflex you need to stabilize the bird around you. If you wouldn't have it, you would have just a big blur because the trees will constantly work by. So this allows us to have a stable representation of the bird around us. This is called the optokinetic reflex. And directional selectivity, which I showed you, this ancient pathway, is mediating this reflex. And I can just prove you very simply with an experiment that if I eliminate starburst cells from the retina, here is now the optokinetic reflex, now measured. Here, looking at eye motion. So this is a slow follow of the trees, and you jump back and slowly follow and jump back. If I eliminate them, there is no optokinetic reflex. And a reminder of the conservation, both human and mouse have these starburst cells in the retina. Okay, so why do we have to know about this? And I show you now a human disease that really a disease of computation. We very recently discovered that, and I'd like to tell you the argumentation why we should care about cell types in the brain, in the retina, and why is it important for medicine. So the argument is the following, that you have these different neuronal elements that do computation, and I showed you that we know that they have different gene expression patterns. That means that some of the genes they express is unique. Perhaps not unique in the brain, but unique within the retina or in the brain region. And what we know about human genetics, that we constantly bombarded by mutations. And so all of us, all of you, are actually mutant of some proteins, but some of us are unlucky, and if we hit cell type specific genes, what we expect that if the gene is important for the function of the cell, and the cell is important for the circuitry and the behavior, what we expect that there will be a disease symptom somewhere the computational will not function. Now, of course, I don't know what you see. So most likely, you have all sorts of mutations in your eye. I have all sorts of mutations in the eye. But this is not a fundamental. Maybe I don't see so well motion than you, but we just don't know. We can never compare our vision. But in some cases, when we hit a gene which is truly important from a reflex or something that all of us use for survival or some basic, then we find a disease symptom. And so to find these diseases, we were very interested how to find these diseases that localize not to photoreceptor. Photoreceptor disease causes blindness. We are interested in computational diseases. So what we did is simply look at an atlas of cell type transcriptomes we made and take all the known human genetic mutations that people gathered. There are all sorts of databases about that. So here shown all sorts of human diseases and the relevant genes. Here are the cell types. And what you can see here is that there are three mutations in this number 7 circuit element, which is nothing else than this famous starburst amacrine cell. And here is one of them that caught our attention. This is called FRMD7. These are the circuit elements in the retina, and is very highly expressed, but only in that cell type, not only in others. Then we looked at the disease, and here I just show you again, and this is what you see. So this is a very well-known disease. It's idiopathic congenital nystagmus. It's not a rare disease. This is 1 out of 1,000 patients have it. And 70% of the cases, what you find is the gene is called FRMD7. And here comes the important point, is that what people name this disease is this constant movement of the eye in the dark. But there is another very important symptom. You know, disease have many symptoms usually, which is not shown here and not in the name, namely that these patients completely lack the horizontal optokinetic reflex, but the vertical is completely normal. And I just told you that starburst amacrine cells are involved in optokinetic reflex. And I also told you that if there's a problem, we lose them. So this was an entry site. So let's look at the patients, just to show you that they completely lack the horizontal optokinetic reflex. Again, here we are looking at the optokinetic reflex. The following of the stripes is time and space. You look very nicely. They follow these trees that are moving. And the patient have zero follow. This is just the random motion of the eye. We calculate how much they actually follow. It's zero. And the important point, that the same patients, when I tell them that follow the stripes, they beautifully follow. So the reflex is not working, but the motor system is working. So you show here. In the vertical domain, everything is normal. So it's only the horizontal part. And now we make a transgenic mice. Look at what that does. And although there is absolutely zero vibration, so that's a different symptom, what you see is a complete lack of the horizontal optokinetic reflex, but the vertical is normal. So that's identical to the human phenotype. Just to show you how amazing the phenotype is, that this is a normal mouse following the trees. See how when I reverse the direction, it just follows the other way. And this mutant has absolutely zero follow. It just stares ahead. OK, so now comes the question, where is the defect? And here is where multi-heterodes are completely amazing. Because in the old time, imagine you have spent probably like 3-4 years until you figured out what is the defect. And now you have an electrode array. You put the retina, and the next day you know where it is. And here is the normal von der Waal type with the 4 directional selective cells represented. And here is the mutant, which is all the directional selectives at the vertical domain, but none in the horizontal domain. OK, so that tells us that there is some problem with the directional selective cell. The question is, what is the problem? So there are 3 possibilities. One, that the horizontal directional cell ganglion cells are missing, which is unlikely because the mutation is expressed in the starburst semiclean cells. The second one is the starburst cells do not connect to the horizontal ganglion cells. And the third one, that asymmetric connectivity I showed you is lost in the horizontal domain but present in the And I don't want to just show you that indeed it's the last one. So that everything is perfect except it is the connectivity strength which is problematic. So here, the starburst cells are normal in mutant and control. The directional selective cells in the horizontal domain are just as normal, the same number in the mutant as in the control. The morphologies of the directional selective cells are normal. And this is what is not normal. So that's the only important slide here, that we have a technology to record from the directional selective cells what the starburst cells are telling. And this is a normal directional selective cell. You see that it has an asymmetric inhibition. This is motion direction. And then when the motion is in this direction, there's a lot of inhibition, very little in this side. And in the disease, you see that the inhibition is coming from all directions. OK, so this is why understanding of circuit elements is important. Because the only way we can treat the disease is if we understand it. And our brain is full of thousands of different cell types. If, you know, it is not, in a computer, you cannot throw Coca-Cola and hope that something specific will happen. And this is the dilemma in neuroscience, in how to treat diseases which are localized to cell types, that we have to come up with cell type targeted strategies. And José already told you, the work with Denis Dalcara and others, that to try to target cell types for repair, and he is just an example, tells you that there's no other way to go for repair than to understand what cell types do and then and figuring out clever strategies for repair. Now, of course, that's not a full understanding. All that I told you, that I know where is the disease, or I hope that I know where is the disease, which cell types, and what is the mechanism, but I still don't know what FRMD is doing. And now we're in a new domain, a molecular domain, where we have complete zero understanding. And we hope that the whole community will build up an understanding why and how this protein is involved, is figuring out what is left and right. OK, so this was a story about the retina and a story about why circuit elements do matter. And what I like now to exit the retina and start to march toward the brain and show you that, unlike the retina, we will have problems of understanding higher brain centers by this simplistic view of an image processor. So the first dilemma that we have 20 neuronal movies coming from the retina. Then they flow to the area called the lateral geniculate nucleus, from here to the primary visual cortex, and then to many other areas. And one of the dilemmas is that if we see in the retina that these cells combine information, and now we have 20 movies, the LGA must be infinitely complex when they start to recombine them, and the cortex even more. So we need methods that go to a single cortical cell and somehow able to tell that who is talking to that single cortical cell and how the retina, which LGN cells and which retinal cells. And I'd like to, don't like to go into all the recording, I'd like to just suggest that these little viruses that can walk one step can be trained to walk two steps. And in my view, that will be one way we can approach the problem, is go to a single cortical cell, we learn what it does, then step back and step back again and try to connect together the retinal processing elements with cortical processing elements. And indeed, just to show you some images, that this is a single cell in the visual cortex where we can initiate the virus, then we can let the virus to walk to those that talk to them. This is in the visual cortex. And we can now build not only viruses that label them, but much more intelligent viruses that also record from the elements that are labeled. And that's, to me, the key, is that now there are many cells talking to me. I have a virus that's able to go to them, but I equip them with molecular sensors that allow me to record from them as they get labeled. So these viruses carry a genetically encoded sensor that allow us to image their activity. And this is what we see, a single cell connected circuitry in the retina, in the cortex, and some in the LGN are shown here. And now we have the ability to record from all of these connected elements because we have this sensor inside, we have this sensor, so we can show the retina all sorts of movies, and then we show this pattern of activity and the hope that we can reconstruct from a single cortical cell all the way what the retina is doing. Okay, so this is what I told you so far, that the retina is an image processor. It sends things to the LGN and cortex, and we hope to understand at one point exactly how these things combine. And now comes the trouble with the view that the whole thing is an image processor. So the first thing I like to note is that there are many visual areas, V1 to V30, I don't know how many, as José showed you, is a big discovery from Fonescence group. And initially what you see, that you see maps of visual space, mosaics. And as we go to higher and higher centers, we lose these maps. And we find cells in these higher centers that are truly amazing. There are cells which respond very selectively to certain faces, but not others. And not only to faces, but the concepts of a person. So this cell would fire whatever orientation you would show your face, would fire when you show your name, would fire when you talk and you listen to it. So it's not just visual. These are very complex cells that now respond to specific faces. And finally, what our original belief was that, you know, now we are very, once you have these cells, you're very close to the percept. So what we hoped is that the whole field, at the end, we find the cells that correspond to the percept. And this is when the trouble comes. So let's just simply ask yourself, how can we describe a percept? And imagine you're looking at my face now, and I ask yourself that, please describe the elementary notions of the percept you have about me. And I think that two things you would mention. One is that my face is stable in space. You don't see my face is jumping on, right, around. You see that I'm rather stable. And I'm also stable in time. So you somehow feel that, you know, my face was here a minute ago and is still here, and I have this feeling of continuity. The trouble is that if I look into your eye, what I see is that your eye, while you are looking at my face, is jumping all over. It's actually making saccadic eye movements. Okay. And now, here is the dilemma. The dilemma is that this is your percept, and that's what comes to your brain. Okay. So there is a problem. So the problem is that perhaps you can all wrong, which I just told you, right? This is. But before getting to that conclusion, let me just explore our percept. Okay, so now what I will do is that for a while you have to just forget about what I told you about this image processor. But let's explore the possibilities, what could happen. So there are two possibilities. Well, before I get to the two possibilities, I like to do an experiment with you. And the question I like to raise is, again, continuously seeing that how much you're actually listening to reality. And this is an experiment on you. And you have to figure out in a movie that who was the killer. Okay, so pay very close attention. Who is the killer? Because I will ask you at the end. That's the game here. And you will see that it will tell us something about vision.
Clearly, somebody in this room murdered Lord Smythe, who, at precisely 3:34 this afternoon, was brutally bludgeoned to death with a blunt instrument. I want each of you to tell me your whereabouts at precisely the time that this dastardly deed took place.
I was polishing the brass in the master bedroom.
I was buttering his lordship's scones below stairs, sir.
Why, I was planting my petunias in the potting shed.
Constable, arrest Lady Smythe.
But how did you know?
Madam, as any horticulturist will tell you, one does not plant petunias until May is out. Take her away.
That's right, madam.
It's just a matter of observation. The real question is, how observant were you?
Check now. Just. This is what.
Clearly, somebody in this room murdered Lord Smythe, who, at precisely 3:34 this afternoon, was brutally bludgeoned to death with a blunt instrument. I want each of you to tell me your whereabouts.
This was all ongoing while you were
watching. The time that this dastardly deed took place.
I was polishing the brass.
There was a different person on the floor.
I was buttering his lordship's scones below stairs, sir.
I was planting my petunias in the potting shed.
Constable, arrest Lady Smythe.
Okay. So that was a demonstration that vision is much more than the photons that come to your eye. The first dilemma arrived when I showed you that actually my face is jumping on your retina. Then I showed you this, that you're completely blind to changes as long as you imagine that things are continuous. So what we'll do in the last 20 minutes is explore what is happening out here. So there are two ways to explain what you showed. There's one way to explain that it is still there is no problem here. All what I've shown you, that there is a sophisticated video editor in your brain that registered images in space and cuts out the video during blinks and eye movements. That is possible, right? I can write an algorithm which simply does the same thing, make a continuous movie off from jumping movie if I do some correlation-based cutting. But there is another explanation, that there is a stable, continuous internal representation of the visual world that predicts what's out there, and the retinal movies serve just as a reality check. And we may update what is in the mind's eye if two conditions are met. First, we pay attention to the image detail, and second, there is a difference between the external and internal image. And this is like I told you, is that there is an internal representation, what we call is a mind's eye. And I'd like to show you the properties of your mind's eye. So the first thing to test it is a very clever experiment was done before, that people do the fMRI. It is a way you can image humans while they are performing some task. And they show them all sorts of images, chairs, faces, for a while. And then they ask them, what you see that the activation of the lateral geniculate nucleus, V1, and many of the other visual areas. And then they ask them to close their eyes and simply imagine what they have seen. And this is what fMRI reveals when they imagine essentially the same brain areas lights up from LGN all the way up. So this tells us something, that we have an internal image that using the same machinery as our normal, except of the retina. The retina is completely standalone. Now the question is that what is happening when I close my eye and look at, and imagining your face? If there is a mind's eye, there must be some better representation, and I have to able to recall it. So the question we will ask is that how this is recalled, where is the recall center, and where is the actual image stored? And the answer to this came actually very early, but it was fairly unnoticed for a while. And this comes from recording from Penfield and Perrault in Montreal from patients when they're performing epilepsy. And they noticed something truly remarkable. So they had to map the area with an electrode. So they perform epilepsy. They first find encephalography was the general area. They open up the brain. They have an electrode to go around to localize, to find the focal element. And they found something truly remarkable. The remarkable was that in some cases, when they stimulated different positions here, the patient who was conscious started to report remarkable things. When they stimulated this point, 22, this patient says, oh gee, robbers are coming at me with guns. Then they stopped stimulating. This is not very nice to hear that. So they went to area 23 and stimulated here. And now the patient says, and there was a robber. He wasn't in front, he was off to the left side. That's also not so nice, so they went to area 24. And then the patient continues exactly when they stimulated and only when they stimulated that, yes, robbers, they are coming after me. So they went through more than 1,000 patients and they had some really amazing conclusions. So this is humans. This is not a mouse or rabbit or anything that you don't, it might be just different. That they stimulated actually all across the entire brain surface, and nowhere else except in this region they could evoke these memories. So they already know that to evoke these memories you have to be somewhere here in the temporal lobe. Sometimes you get auditory, sometimes you get visual, and sometimes you get both of the memories. And then they made four conclusions. The first one is that at least one recall center is localized, the one they found. The second is, this is not when the memory is stored. So how did they know that? Because they excised the area. When they found it, they excised it because that was their duty to take it away so there is no more epilepsy. And what they found that they later, after the surgery, asked about the robbers and their experience, and they perfectly remember all details about the robber. So although it was important for recall, it's not important for storing the memory. And then very importantly, and this is really striking, that stimulation of different locations results in the same hallucination content. So it seems that once you recall an event, it is somehow occupies your mind and no other areas are sort of bringing in the same experience. And the last one is that these memories were not just simple facts that, you know, I remember that, you know, the English translation of this and word is this and that. Rather, they were vivid, but time-fragmented memories, little chunks of videos together with audio that came back to them. Okay, so we know that there is at least one area when memory is recalled from. The question is, and this is the biggest question for neuroscience, is that when is the memory, right? I want to find the mind's eye. I know where is my eye. I know where is your eye, but I know where is the mind's eye. No one knows. And it is indeed completely unknown. So this is where I finish. I just tell you that the biggest mystery in my view in visual neuroscience is to find the mind eye. And I like to summarize in two sentences. a few sentences, that José and myself talked about vision, and we started our description about an image processor, your eye, LGN, V1, the flow of information, image processing. And this is what I call a real process, because we have the image, we can record from cells, we can tell, you know, who is doing what. But vision is much more. It's just like a complex number, which can be represented by a real number and its imaginary part. We have an imaginary part of our vision, and this is an internal representation. We have very little clues where it is, how it works, but I showed you an experiment that suggested that this is real. And as I told you, how these two works together is currently, we don't understand. And if there are students here, probably they will occupy the next 100 years of figuring out these processes. Thank you very much.